The following lecture by Imam W. Dean Muhammad, Muslim American spokesman for Human Salvation, titled Race and Genetics from an Islamic Perspective, was recorded at the University of Cincinnati in Cincinnati, Ohio, April 25, 1995.
Thank you. Praise be to Allah. Peace be on you. We greet Assalamu Alaikum. We witness that God is only one, and that Muhammad, to whom the Quran was revealed, is the last prophet, God's servant, and his messenger. And what follows of that salute, of that traditional salutation. We also would like to acknowledge our thanks and appreciation for the efforts that you have made here, the Imam, the mosque, masjid, along with the students and also the student association and those who sponsored the Muslim Student Association and other student bodies and those who have cooperated to make this effort possible and to make our presence here possible. We thank you very much. Our presentation is on Islam, race, and genetics. And I would like to begin by saying our Prophet, when he was asked, presented with a problem, I think, of genetics by someone who was bothered. This person had a child, a man had a child, and the child didn't look like the other children. And he was kind of bothered by that. So he went to our Prophet, prayers and peace be upon our Prophet, and brought our Prophet this problem. And our Prophet asked him, say, well, do you have animals that you raise? And he said, yes. He said, well, do you notice that sometimes an animal will come from two animals and won't look like the others? He said, yes. That was it. Islam is a religion of peace. It is a religion of unity, Tawheed, the unity of creation. We believe this creation is one vast scheme incorporating many, many other schemes. We believe in the oneness of matter, in the oneness of human beings. We believe that though we are racially different, colors and features, etc., that we belong to one human family, the human race. And we also believe that God has created us to agree in that unity, that man has been put on this earth to finally find peace in that unity. And anything short of that unity will not give him peace. This is our belief in Islam. We also believe that internal peace, peace within our hearts and our minds and our souls, depends also on how we relate to the external world. And we need to discover that oneness of matter, that oneness of life, that Tawheed, T-A-U-H-I-D or T-A-U-H-E-E-D, that Tawheed that is given to us in Islam. we also know that many things lead to the ugly condition of race in people. Race pride is good, to have pride in one's achievements as a people, in your achievements as a people, to have pride in your spirit as a people. To have such pride is good. And anyone who can't find such pride in their own race, they are really having trouble relating to their own creation and relating to the external world, or the world as the external world as God intended for it to be, or as the Creator intended for it to be. There are many things that I believe contribute to racism, and I don't want to deal with that so much. We want to bring you what is the position of Islam. But I do want to mention a writer who wrote a book, Race and the Democratic Society, France Boas, B-O-A-S, who in the early 50s, I believe, addressed this problem in our Western society and the modern world, and I believe made a sincere effort to awaken a desire in the intellectuals of this nation, America, to look for scientific answers and to support the propagation of scientific answers for the differences in the race, whether it's black and white or brown, red or yellow. And he, this writer, Franz Boas, who authored this book, in a certain portion of the book, he used terms like melanin and keratin to explain how we get this pigmentation, the black or the white or the in-between. But I think the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, who only got 3 years elementary school education in Georgia, did more for me than Franz Boas did with his statement, and I believe it was influenced by the Quran, his study of the Quran. His statement was, Elijah Muhammad's statement, we get our color from the sun. We get our color from the sun. Now, if we get our color from the sun, then we know that what we're talking about is just a light tan and a deep tan, or no tan at all, when we're talking about skin color, if we would accept all of Elijah Muhammad's explanation for the pigmentation in the skin. But we know also we have differences in our features. The people in Europe, especially up north, they will have king features, and the more we go down toward the south, the blunter the features are. The blunter the features are. And I'm really somewhat relieved to see education television addressing the differences in race. Upon that observation, that climatical differences make for differences in our features, even in the textures of our hair. All of this is determined by physical environment. The sun, the amount of sun we get, the amount of moisture in the air, the heat or the coldness of the air. If the air is very hot, then we need bigger openings, especially if it's humid. We need hot and humid air, we need bigger openings to get enough air. And if it's very cold, the nose wants to keep too much air out because it's not good. It shocks the system, the hot system, so it wants it to come in very slow and in very small quantities, not in big gushes. So the nose is keener, sharper, and thinner to keep too much air from coming in because it's cold. Now, these are just signs of nature. And I begin by telling you, my honorable audience, that our prophet, prayers and peace be upon him, when he was presented with a problem of genetics, he directed the person who had the problem to look and observe what is in nature. And I think that if we could do that, we would save ourselves from the burden of myth, the oppressive burdens of falsehood, doctrinal secrecy that is natural in his language, but unnatural in his practices. Perhaps it's truthful in his language, but it's false in its practices. And I'm not the first one to mention things like this now. I'm just here really to remind you, because I believe that I'm on this campus and I respect your minds, and I know you, many of you perhaps know more in the area of science than I do, because you perhaps have taken studying in that area. You have studies in that area. You perhaps, some of you might even be majoring in that area. So I'm not pretending that I'm bringing you something you don't know, but I want us to remember these things and then accept these things in our daily thinking, in our daily needs, our daily needs, to deal with each other, our daily faults of each other. We should accept the truth and the fact and not be overcome or be moved and directed by the falsehoods, by the falsehood. And a lot of these falsehoods, I repeat, are doctrinal falsehoods, doctrinal falsehoods. We know how man has erred under pressures to survive materially, and he has looked for excuses to exploit the weaker people, and he has sometimes, in this state of mind, looked at Scripture and misread it, and used it to justify his evils. So you find in Islam, and I see right in the Quran this, you find in Islam that the problem of what we call false worship and racial arrogance are tied together. You know, if we look at the story of man's beginning and how he was challenged by Satan, Shaitan, in our religion, Satan or Shaitan, you will see an arrogance pointed to. Scripture points to an arrogance of intellect, or a being who had an arrogant intellect. And his arrogant intellect prevented him from obeying God and accepting to deal justly or to be fair by God's man or by God's creation. God says in the Quran, in our holy book, that when he presented his plan for the creation of a human being on earth, a human being made from simple earth, the Satan, or the, he was not called Satan at the time, he was called Iblis. The angel, I should say the jinn. The jinn, who was in the role of an angel as the leader of the angels in the heavens, he refused to accept that God would give a high station to a human, a mortal, that he would make from the earth. From the earth. From dust. From clay. All of this is simple earth. This is the simple beginning of earth before there is any evolution seen. Any traces of any evolution. Dust, clay, and mud. He was going to make the man from such. So the Satan, he rejected that. And he said, the Satan said, I am better than he. Isn't this what the racist says? The racist says that too. I am better than he. And he meant he was better in his makeup. He was better in his creation, or better in his natural makeup, than the man that God was about to put on the earth and give trusteeship, or give him custodianship in the earth, to care for the earth, to care for everything. And the language of Quran, in the Quran, says that he ever, mean he refused to accept this new creation of God, that God would entrust with that great responsibility, and he was stuck about it. Abba was stuck about it. That he became, he refused, and he became blown up with self-importance. He stuck about it. He became big in his own eyes, big in his own estimation, bigger than his own reality. He stuck about it. He became bigger than his own reality. And anyone, black or white, who think that he has, or she has, a superiority because of your color or the race you belong to, you have taken the same position. You have taken the position of Iblis. And usually what's behind real racism is not the stupid victim of racism or the stupid one who adopts racism or who becomes the racist. It's the intellectual racist. The intellectual racist. He is the big one behind it all. And he is conscious, more conscious of his own interest. It's his self-interest that he sees threatened. His importance. He became self-important, so self-important, and his own worth, or his own worth in his own mind, or his own mind's eye, was exaggerated. He became bigger than his own reality. And so I repeat that in Islam, I believe the two are connected. The two have a connection. The worship of man and racism has a connection. The worship of man is a false worship. And racism is a false idea, a false notion. And they are tied together. We know that our freedom leaders, Dr. King and others, have pointed to greed, material greed, and have said that racism is really a cover for material greed, that really all they want to do is exploit, materially exploit, those that are defenseless. And this is the truth. This is the truth. It was created to exploit those that are defensive, are defenseless. And you know, intellectuals, they are equipped with knowledge of psychology, knowledge of human psychology. If they're not, they can become equipped, they can get equipped with that such knowledge. And in time, they will use the tools of psychology to make those that have defenses lose their defenses. So they don't only prey upon the defenseless, they prey upon the strong to make them lose, to cause them to lose their defenses, so they can make them too victims of racism. Racism is not an African creation. It is a European creation. So what are you African brothers and sisters doing by it? It is the creation of what we have called, the people that we call our enemies in the struggle for freedom and dignity. So what we look like buying something that is an invention of our enemies. The invention of those who victimized us and made us the subjects and the victims of white supremacy. So now, it's strange to me that we would order for our people a belief in some kind of black supremacy and become the second racist establishment on this earth. That beats me. Especially now that we have more than 3 years education. 3 years elementary education. I could see the Honorable Elijah Muhammad in the time of depression in 1931. I could see the Honorable Elijah Muhammad being rescued by Mr. Farad, Mr. W.F. Muhammad, or Mr. Farad, W.D. Farad, some call him, and accepting what Farad told him. I could see that because he only had 3 years elementary school education from Georgia. But I can't see you African black brothers on these prestigious campuses preaching and spreading to each other an idea of black supremacy. I myself was nourished the idea of black superiority from the cradle. My mother told me when she held me as an infant in her arms, she said, before I learned to talk, she was already putting in my ears the doctrine, or you might say the teachings, Or to make it even easier for some of you, the wisdom. Wait a minute, I better make it a little easier. The supreme wisdom of the lost foundation of Islam, or the temple of Islam. She said she was putting that into my ear before I learned to talk. And she said she would point out white folks in the newspaper to me. She said, "Wallace, that's the devil." She wouldn't say it was a white person. She didn't tell me that was a white person. She said, "Wallace, that's the devil. And that's the devil. That's the devil. That's the devil." She said, and one day she was telling me, "They see that devil?" She said, and I, little boy now, little toddler. She said, "I, as a little toddler, I took the picture of the white person and I tore it up. I just tore the picture up." So she put that in me as a little child. And it stayed in me, but the more I got to, I would say, an opportunity, the more I got an opportunity to study and learn things outside of the house and outside of even the temple walls, that burdened my mind. And I began to listen to my father for hints that would help me. And I heard many hints from his mouth that helped me. I finally came to the conclusion that the Honorable Elijah Muhammad was the leader. But he himself was also a student. That the teacher, the strange teacher, who was a foreigner, really, he wasn't African or African-American. He wasn't American at all. Farad was not American at all. But that's what I'm trying to get to, is that strange teacher equipped the Honorable Elijah Muhammad to be the leader. But at the same time, didn't tell him but little. So he left him also with curiosity, with burden on his mind, to understand the strange package that he was given called supreme wisdom. And he told Honorable Elijah Muhammad, he said, "Brother, you have to study it deep." I'm giving you the words of Honorable Elijah Muhammad. These are his words. "Brother," he said, Honorable Elijah Muhammad said, that Farah told him, "Brother, you have to study it deep. It's not on the surface." He said, "Dig deep." And that's what Honorable Elijah Muhammad would tell his ministers. And Honorable Elijah Muhammad obviously was given some hints from Farah that we didn't get. And obviously he had a bit of advantage over us when it came to understanding those doctrinal teachings or esoteric teachings of the Nation of Islam called Supreme Wisdom. And the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, he would sometimes listen to his ministers wrestling with some of the unknowns in the wisdom. And sometimes he would smile. Sometimes I've heard him say, "Brother, I think you own something." But most of the time he said, "No, you have to dig deeper." Most of the time that's what he would say, "No, you don't have it. You have to dig deeper." That's what he would tell him. So I said, I was going to make a long story short. The Honorable Elijah Muhammad, in the last about 3 or 4 years of his life, he showed a big change. I know him. He's my father. He was my father. He is my father. Still is. Dead alive, he's my father. He showed a big change in his spirit. He didn't have the same exciting spirit, enthusiastic spirit. He was kind of a low spirit person, especially when he was talking about the progress of the Nation of Islam, the followers of the Nation of Islam. He was a bit low spirited. And I saw also in him an intent to get me to not go back, but keep going forward. I made trouble for him, but not intentionally, not with a desire to make trouble for him. I made trouble for him because I couldn't think that way anymore. I was disagreeing with the idea of God that I was given as a child. And to disagree with the idea of God that I was given as a child, I had to also disagree with the idea of devil that I was given as a child. Now, I don't think I was falling in love with the white race. I wasn't. And I'm still not in love with the white race. I'm in love with the human race. I want you to understand what was happening to me. My mind just couldn't accept those things that I was given anymore. And I began as a minister of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. I was the minister of Temple Number 12. I began then to speak quite, I would say my tone was quite different from the tone of the rest of the ministers. And the Honorable Elijah Muhammad was told by the national staff that I should be stopped, that they thought I was going to make trouble. The Honorable Elijah Muhammad refused to stop me. He let me continue. It was only when I was reported, this was after I had served a prison term and returned to the Temple of Islam and to the nation. It was only after I was reported for saying that Faraz was not God that the Honorable Elijah Muhammad had a kind of hearing. See, he was the judge. And believe me, the temples had their courts, and they might still have their courts. So he had a hearing. He found me guilty, and he put me out. And I stayed out for a while, but he asked about me, and I would never stop. The law was that you're not supposed to have any contact with anybody in the Temple of Islam when you're put out. When it came to him and my father and my mother, I didn't respect that. Whether they asked me or not, I would write them. I even tried to call a few times. One time, secretary felt so sorry for me, she called and told me your son is on the phone. He refused to speak to me, but I called. And I was using some psychology too. I love my father. I love my father and my mother. It's a pain to be separated from your father and mother that you really love. And really, we had no problem. Some fathers and mothers have problems. Some parents and children have big problems. But really, really, we didn't have any problem. We liked each other's company. My father liked my company. I liked my father's company. We liked each other's company, you know. So we didn't have any personal problem. It was this impersonal thing that had come between us. So I was moved as a son to stay in touch with my father, but believe me, I knew my father was a hard man when it comes to defending his nation of Islam. And what I mean by defending it, he didn't want anything to creep into the thoughts of the members of the nation of Islam that would weaken their faith. And if we, at that time, the strongest faith we had was faith in the idea of God that we was given in the nation of Islam. And he didn't want anything shaking that. He didn't want anything messing with that. And I can't blame him. I didn't hold that against him. So anyway, I did use some psychology. I said to myself, I'm going to make sure he doesn't forget me. And I'll make sure he always will always know that this is not personal. So when he would have his safest day, I would also send him a special message. And my message was that your Savior's day is nearing. I wish you success on your big day. That's what I would tell him. And that softened his heart in time. So the second time I was put out, my brother told me, say, yeah, I put out second time. My brother said, Wallace, say, why don't you try to come back? Say, I think Daddy wants you to come back. He said, the way he was speaking about you at the table, I think he wants you to come back. So I said, okay. I made a request, and he gave me permission to come over and see him. So I came over and saw him, and he sat down at the table. It was It was a table almost like a courtroom table. That wooden table, rectangular table. He sat down, and I'm not going to tell you everything that happened in this situation. But anyway, yeah, it was serious, but it's, in a way, it was a little humorous. He sat down. He said, "Well, son," he said, "you know what you have to do." I said, "Yes, sir." "You have to go before the people." He would ask me, and then I told him, "Yes." He said, "You have to go before the people, and you have to admit that you were wrong." I said, "Yes, sir." So I went before the people, and I told them I was wrong. I said, "I was wrong to disagree with the Honorable Elijah Muhammad." And really, in my own mind, I was saying I didn't really disagree with him. I was disagreeing with his teaching. See, that's how I covered for myself in my own conscience. So I put it that way so my soul could take it. I said I was wrong to disagree with the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. In fact, I told my father, I said, "Daddy, I have no problem with you. My problem is with Mr. Ron, not with you." I said, "I think you have done a good job." And really, he had. And well, let me tell you something else that I have come to strongly believe, and I would say I know it. Mr. Farad himself was not believing in what he taught. But he was using what he taught to change the condition of our people from one of blindness and blind obedience to the white world to one of dissatisfaction and rebellion that he hoped would eventually lead us to even question him. And believe me, there was an African American who actually was back there in the early 30s, who challenged Farad. And obviously he had a little more education than the great majority of the followers back then. Again, it was my father, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, who told us this story, and it was at the dinner table. He usually told us these things at the dinner table, because he was busy. It wasn't dinner time. He wasn't socializing. He was working. Or wasn't having conversation, just for conversation's sake. He was working. With his papers, with his correspondence, with the business of the community, the Nation of Islam, as it was called, whatever. So anyway, it was at the dinner table again, and Honorable Elijah Muhammad said, "Oh yes," he said, he called Farad our savior. Yes, he said, "Oh, our savior." See, he wasn't always talking wisdom and being serious. See, he could relax with us. See, he would have jokes sometime and have fun in conversation. Say sometimes something would be said and it would tickle him so say his face would turn red. His face would flush, he would put red in his face. He said, "One time," said, "I saw him get very, very, very much concerned." Said one of our black brothers challenged him while he was teaching. So he was teaching about the black man being God. Said a black man stood up right while he was talking and said, "Well, if the black man is God, why don't you just leave here and turn it over to me?" Now, if someone way back there in the early 30s, back there at the beginning almost, when Farad was here himself, and he was only among us, we are told, I was a baby back then, for only 3 years. If an African American, a black man with black skin, stood up and challenged him, saw a problem with someone being his color, being our leader, then you know many of us must have had the same problem and didn't say anything. And I was one of them. The more I looked at his face, the more I saw him looking more white than black, the more curious I became.
So how come we can still worship him and pray to him if God is black?
But you know, so many things burden our mind. We was told that the mother that gave birth to Farah was a white woman. A white woman. But a one white woman who had never mixed with the wicked white world. We told that she was always kept in a Muslim society over in the Far East, in Mecca. Actually, it's the Middle East. I guess it was far for us. Far for us. We were taught that really Arabia was in the Far East. It's not in the Far East, it's in the Middle East. But that's what we were taught, you know. So we were told that his mother was a white woman and his father was a black man named Alfonso. He even told us his name, Alfonso. See, if you would go to any John Muhammad in Detroit, or Silas, Prophet Silas, wherever he is, maybe even to Farrakhan, some of his ministers, some of the minister Farrakhan's ministers, maybe you'll hear them tell you some of these things, you know. Oh yes, his father was named Alfonso, and his mother was named Baby G. Yeah, and they tried to get Farah the first time, and they missed. They got a girl. And when they saw it was a girl, they said, oops, we missed that time. Now, this is all in the teachings, right? That's all in the teachings. Why I've shared that with you? To show you that there was hints to the wise. Don't take this too serious. See, that kind of language says, don't take it too serious. Yeah. And there's so many other hints. I wish I had time to tell you a lot of these things. But let's get back to Islam on race and genetics. The best help that I find for my own mind, and I believe as a member of the black people in America, or the African people, or African American people of this country, that I, whatever happens to me, to free me, it should be noted. Because there's no race of people that have suffered racism any more than my people. We were the first and the worst victims of racism. Yes. So if something has happened in my mind to bring me relief and to give me a sense of freedom in my soul, and a sense of freedom from my mind or my intellect, then I say, note should be taken. Yes. And believe me, when I read in the Quran how the Quran treats the tendency to buy racism. And there are many races who are not racist, who were not racist earlier, but became racist. See, all races that were not born that way in their family, in the household, or in the homes of their mothers and fathers, like clan children of the clan, or like myself, in the home of my father and mother. Now, I gave a comparison there that's really not fair, because those white people were also conditioned to want to do physical harm to black, to actually want to see blacks exterminated. Some of them want to see blacks exterminated and believe that they, their own hands, should do that job. I was never in any way influenced at home or in the temple while listening to the minister or my father teach to believe that I was to act out my dislike for white folks and go out and do some bodily harm to a white person. I was told to respect them, to even greet them kindly, good day, hello, whatever. I was told if I had a white boss, to give him a fair day's work, not to steal from him, and not to cheat by holding back what I could give him as a laborer or as a worker. So we were not really conditioned to do physical harm or to really be racist in the true sense. We had a racist philosophy, a racist idea, but we were not really racist in the real sense or in the true sense. We would make the follower of Honorable Elijah Muhammad or the Supreme Wisdom become a racist is when that idea is challenged. And the person has to defend that idea. Then he becomes a racist. His ugliness comes up. His ugliness takes over and overpowers the goodness that the temple of Islam established in him. It takes over, and now he's a mean creature because he has to fight off or defend his belief. So to defend it, he has to become wrong, deeper and deeper in his wrong, deeper and deeper in the wrong idea, deeper and deeper in his hatred for whites. So it's intensified when his threat. Those who can give it up, who are threatening and say, well, it doesn't make that much sense. Maybe I should look at it differently. They're saved. But those who say, no, they just desperately hold on to, the white man is the devil by nature, his mama, his wife, his baby, now and to be born is the devil. You know, he holds on to that. And the black man is God. So he holds on to it. And the more he is addressed by language that tends to threaten that or unravel it or prove it wrong, the more he has to hold on to lies, and the more lies he has to hold on to, the more lies he has to reach out for, and eventually his nature is so warped that the Honorable Elijah Muhammad wouldn't want him if he came back and saw it. Yes! But thank God that only happens for a few. The great majority of us, we don't fight like that. If we don't know, we just say, well, I'll wait and see. Maybe Allah will show me one day. And if we believe that we should change, we change. The best help that came to me from the Quran. The best help for my social sense of social esteem. The best help for my, you know, I guess all of us maybe who were searching the world of ideas for support or for more understanding, for more light. I guess we looked at communism. Malcolm looked at communism when he was in jail. I looked at communism too. Not with a desire, not with a thought that I was going to choose, but just to know what's there. I was curious. I was looking to see what help, where is there some help? And I read through the idea of the material dialectics and read a lot about the communist idea, and nothing that I read impressed me more than what I read in Quran. The brotherhood of communism to me was not as impressive as the brotherhood of Islam. The brotherhood of Islam, to me, is just as rich in its science and in its social teachings and in its economic idea as communism or any other ism that I have come upon on this world. While it is spiritually based, based on taqwa, belief in God, obedience to God, above all things, obey God, above all worship God, above all obedience, obey God. That's what it's based on. But still, I found in the language of the Quran, insights, concepts, motivations for my social esteem, more powerful, more richer than anything I found in communism or capitalism or anything else. I could go over a lot of those with you, but that would take a lot of time, more time than I want to take. I'm going straight to the idea of the origin of man in the Quran. And it is the same for the great religions, but the Quran gives it, I think, in a way that respects the need in the rational mind for understanding. God says that you all are children, are descended from one father, Adam. And God said, and he was made from dust. And God says of that Adam, God didn't say, and he was the man of sin. No. God says of that father, see, I shouldn't hold it. I shouldn't wait this. This was for the conclusion. I shouldn't give it. It should be right here, right now. I believe what messes us up in Western society, the idea in Christian West, that we are the children of the first sinner. That ain't a good thing to be thinking about, or a good thing to be remembering. I'm the child of the first sinner. My first parent was a sinner. That's a bad way to start out if you want to feel some social esteem. You see?
End of side one. At this time, please fast forward the cassette to the end before you continue on side two.
So, Islam does not tell us that. The Quran, God's word in the Quran, does not tell us that. His word in the Quran, and believe me, the Bible hints something different from what it says. If you study the Bible very carefully, it hints a different idea than that one I just gave you, the idea of original sin. So that idea of original sin is a great mystery, and Christians, if you're in the audience and you're going to stay Christians, believe me, you shouldn't let it bother you anymore. Take it from a Muslim that God has blessed with insights into the Bible. You are not the children of a sinner. And your first father was not a sinner. Your first father was an obedient servant of God. And whatever your first father did, according to our Quran and according to my understanding of the Bible, was done unintentionally. He never intentionally did wrong or went astray. So all of us should have that in our mind, instead of that idea that we are children of a father, a first father, who was a sinner, who brought all of us under sin because of his sin. The first father in Islam is the father of noble descendants of the European family, of the African family, of the Asian family, of every family on this earth. All of us are noble descendants of our noble father, Adam. So we believe that nobility is the created gift to man. It's a created gift to man. That God created us for nobility, for honor, for nobility, for social dignity, for social esteem, for great worth, even a bit above the station of angels. But only if we obey God. If we disobey him, we are told that that same high station that God created you for, you can lose it and fall to the lowest of all the creatures in creation. And again, when I'm told in the Quran that it is God who made your features, says Surah. Pardon me. No. This is different. I'll get to that later. Not features. It is God who made your design, your picture, your design. It is God who made your design or your picture, and he made it beautiful and excellent. And he's talking about every one of us. So I'm sure if you can see by now that I'm not saying that there's any support in Islam for racism. There's no support in Islam for any genetic superiority of one race over another. I'm sure that you've come to that conclusion already. So if you're expecting me to give some Quranic support for those ideas, I'm sure you're ready to leave, or you're greatly dissatisfied. Now, says,
God. It is God that made our surah, and he made it beautiful and excellent.
Or most beautiful and most excellent.
What is this surah? God wants us to see the common picture. That there is the racial picture, and there is the human picture. The racial picture is not the big deal with God. The human picture is the big deal with God. So he used this picture in the singular, not in the plural. He said, it is God who made your picture, one picture, and made it most beautiful and excellent. That is your human picture. Now, you know, I'm the kind of unorthodox teacher or preacher. Somebody told me once, said, you don't teach, say you preach. Say you don't lecture, you talk. I say, well, they sure sit for a long time and listen to my talk. And they do. They do. I have people fought with me who will listen all night to me talk. And they think my talk is more enriching than your lectures. I'm talking about those who criticize me. I'm talking to those who criticize me. Yeah. Now, let me throw a little humor in here. You know, we believe in Islam that the human body, as God created it, is a Muslim. This is not to say that your body is not a Christian. We ain't saying that. The body becomes a Christian because of influences. You accept Christianity, now your body is under a Christian. But we believe that the body, as God created it, is a Muslim. And this speaks for the logic in Islam. This is the logic in Islam that says the body is a Muslim. The body is a Muslim. The human body is a Muslim. Now, the human body is a Muslim. A Muslim is not a racist. Did you ever see a human body perspire in Russian? You ever hear the human body sneeze in Russian? Cough in Russian? Exude liquid or whatever in Russian? You ever see somebody smile in Russian? I don't know how to detect someone smiling in Russian. A frown in Russian? No, the human body is one. And the same for everybody. And God says there's a sign for you in the differences that are in your tongue, your languages, and your colors. There's a sign for you. So these things are signs. And God says that he made us different to bring us together. Isn't that wonderful? I say bring us together because that is part of the meaning. He made us different so that we would recognize each other, so that we would get acquainted with each other. Now, you know, if we who are one particular race or ethnic group learn of another race or ethnic group that are doing impressive things or has an impressive life, we want to come closer to them. We want to at least study them. We want to know something about them. So our differences do attract us to study each other, become acquainted with each other. But God wants us to know that we shouldn't study each other to get advantages over each other, like the Iblis, the Satan, or the racist. We should study each other so that we will become helpful, mutually benefit. That's why we should study each other. How can we mutually benefit? The West is progressing. America is progressing. They are advocating the cultural interests that we don't be locked out of the world culturally, that we come out of our shell and get acquainted with other cultures, that we accept and respect other cultures so that we can have a better, a more human world. This is really progress for America. I remember a time when you just wore a different dress and you might be hated by people that never saw you before. They wouldn't know whether you were a saint or a devil or angel or what, and wouldn't care. You just didn't conform to their idea of an American. And they would reject you and hate you, they didn't want you around them. I know because my mother was treated that way when they saw her in the public with her head wrapped up and her long dress on. Many times she was treated mean. She was treated very, very, very ugly by American people. In fact, most of the time she would be treated that way when I was a boy. And it took a long time, it took decades before we saw change in this society. Oh, yes. So in Islam, the help for a man overcoming his racial arrogance is the belief in your own created beauty and excellence. That beauty and excellence is not found in your physical color or in your physical features. That beauty and excellence is found in your qualities and your talents and in your qualities and in your ability. That's internal. Your heart, your soul, your intellect, in its innocence, is the excellence that God sees in all of us. And that excellence can grow in excellence if it keeps its innocence. It can grow in excellence. It can benefit from a bigger world than the world of the races. If the white man was still under white supremacy, he would have by now been removed from the earth. He's not anymore under white supremacy. The big boom for industry with the creation of the modern machines and modern weaponry gave the white man a temporary advantage and superiority over other people. And that would only keep him in position of superior until the people got themselves in a situation where they could challenge that kind of superiority. And we know the Russians came to challenge that kind of superiority. Soon the Red China challenged that superiority. And now there are many nations that are not threatened by that kind of superiority. So the white man cannot have that kind of muscle anymore. So he has to express the humanity that he says was prescribed for him by the founding fathers, who wrote the preamble to the Constitution of these United States. In these words, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal and endowed by their Creator. Creator. With certain inalienable rights. Among these rights, liberty and the pursuit of happiness. And it was Dr. King who challenged America, didn't he? To fulfill that promise. And great progress was made. Especially with the help from the agitators. Who said, we don't want to live with you, just give us some states to ourselves. Don't think that civil rights would have had that much attention if that wasn't that gadfly over there, that agitator. Saying, here's a worse alternative. But if you don't want to swallow that pill, then think about this one we got for you. So though we were working apart, working against each other, in a real way, we were actually helping each other. The civil rights movement was helping us, and we were helping the civil rights movement. Attacking the arrogant white man from two directions, left and right. One knocking at the door of his claim to humanity, and the other one telling him you ain't got no humanity. Yeah, that's what it was. The Christian movement headed by Dr. King was knocking on the door of his humanity, say, wake up, sleeping humanity. You got big claims, but you're not awake to your own claims. And then standing at the door was Army Elijah Muhammad, a little man standing back there saying, why are you knocking at the door? Ain't nothing there. The man ain't got no humanity here. He's a devil. He was created to be a devil, and that's all he can be. The body is a Muslim. The human body is a Muslim. Once the Prophet, peace and blessings be on him, the Prophet stood up for the deceased body. They were taking it to the resting place. And he was sitting, and he stood up when he recognized that the deceased body was passing. And some of his father was asked, say, why you don't stand up for a living body? How come you stand up for a dead body? And his answer was, that body never disobeyed its master. So he didn't put sin on the human body. He put sin on the mind in the human body. He said that body never disobeyed its master. And that's what the body was created for. The body was created to serve us. To serve us. If we respect its urgings, it urges us not to do wrong. If we respect its urgings, then it will serve us for the better. But if we ignore its better urgings, it will eventually not try to speak to us. You know, and that's the way nature is, isn't it? That's the way nature is. You know, if you keep ignoring the good nature won't respond. And good deeds erase bad deeds. Isn't that what we taught? Good deeds erase bad deeds. So I'm going to conclude this talk and open for questions. And I conclude it with this. The modern world knows the belief in the genetic superiority of one people over another is ignorance. We're not living in the dark ages of America anymore. We're living in the time of enlightenment and the abundance of scientific facts. So we're not living in the dark ages. So anyone trying to promote the superiority, genetic superiority of one people over another, they're just beating the ground and getting no results. They will get no results. You will only be able to attract a few of the people, and most of the people you attract will be hypocrites.
That's right.
You will live to see them even betray you.
That's right.
The idea just won't stand up anymore. The world is too filled with scientific information. I appreciate men like Franz Boas, who I mentioned, who thought that this racism was a plague, this racist idea was a plague on the beautiful plan or idea that this democracy is to mature for and come into one day. And believe me, I still think we're short of the complete idea of democracy that's in the preamble to the Constitution of the United States. And it is a heavenly idea. A heavenly idea that we always will have to reach up to. But I do believe that we are making great progress, and don't let the condition of another race or the condition of your race break your spirit. We African Americans, we blacks, we should not let the condition of our race break our spirit. We shouldn't feel ourselves not achieved because our race is a failure. In Islam, you don't take on the burden of anybody. Everybody has to, every tub has to sit on its own bottom. Huh? Yes. In Islam, you don't take on the burden of other people and let it break your spirit. You take on the burden of other people to change them. But you don't take on that burden if it's hurting your spirit or breaking your spirit. In other words, you don't make yourself guilty with them.
That's right.
No. You're not guilty of being a failure if they're a failure. If your race is a failure and you are an achiever, then have
uplift spirit.
Yes, sir.
Keep your pride and your dignity in your own achievements. And try to educate them, try to have some time to address their problem, but never let the failure of your lot crush your spirit when you know yourself that you are an achiever.
Yes,
thank you very much. Peace be on you. As-salamu alaykum.
Get some questions and answers for about 10 minutes. So I would ask that you come to this mic if you have a question. And I mean, don't wait to 2 minutes before the last person, because we're gonna be moving with these questions. And I would say to you, we don't need a short story at this time. Time is short. We just need to answer the questions direct, and then ma'am will answer the question, and we can get on from go on from there. Now.
Okay, I have a question. My question is, for you to do on the front of the deck, and how long do you think before we could drop here tonight?
Now, please repeat it, because I'm not hearing clearly.
What do you do on the front of the deck, and how long do you think before we wipe out here tonight?
Oh, okay, I got the question. Affirmative action. Yes, affirmative action, as we all know, is in a lot of trouble, and has been in trouble for some years now. You know, I think, it's a big question. Let me put it this way. I think it's time for African Americans to question our loyalty to the Democratic Party. And study both parties and take the good from both according to the dictates of our own intelligence and needs. Take the good from both and not depend so heavily on government for answers in our life. I know I sound like a Republican to you, but I'm not registered as a Republican or as a Democrat, but I do vote. And I would say also that too much, I would say, relief won't be good for us. We are people who began as a strong people. Frederick Douglass was a strong man. Harriet Tubman, a strong woman. And all the others that I could name, they were strong people. We all know that. But they didn't begin with a lot of help, did they? What made them strong was being denied. So I don't say we should have an unfair law. No, if there's an unfair law, we should seek to change it. But we shouldn't be looking for too much help from the federal government. The strongest people on this earth are not people that's helped a whole lot by government. They are people that do a whole lot and make it possible for strong governments to come into existence. So I would like to see us not ask for too much from the government, but ask a whole lot of ourselves. That's what I'd like to see.
I want you to explain if there's a difference in Muslims who are just simply against Islam. There's a difference in their understanding in terms of recognizing Allah as Allah. Wrong.
best understanding of the term Allah, to get the best definition for the term Allah, we should go to the Quran. Any term used in the Quran, the best definition for it, the best encyclopedia, the best lexicon, whatever, is the Quran itself. Now, if the believer, the new believer, the new convert, we say convert, or the one who accepts Islam just today, right now, if they are blessed to have imam, leader, or teachers, or educational materials, literature, that can come from the pen of someone or from or some persons who have that complete picture, a complete definition of Allah, there'll be no problem. But if the leader or the teachers themselves don't see the full meaning of Allah in the text of the Quran, there's a problem. And believe me, the problem didn't just start on the shores of America. There are sections of the Muslim world, Ismailis and some others, who have ideas of Allah that are more foreign to the Quran than they are to some other people's religions or people's holy books. You'll find a likeness of their idea of God in some other scripture and not in the Quran. And there is a danger for African Americans coming from Trinitarian idea of God and especially coming from the temple of Islam, or Nation of Islam idea of God, to accept the religion, say, yes, I accept. But they still have some influences from that teaching that they had in the temple of Islam and the church is influencing their idea of Allah. There is a danger. So really, when we ask someone to make shahada, we should let them know that they are witnessing that God is the creator of the heavens and the earth, and there is no son, no descendants from him. Man descended from man, not from God. See, this is contrary to the idea in some religions. Some religions believe man descended from God. Man descended from man, not from God. We should make that very plain. And that God is the creator of everything, and that God is bigger than you, bigger than your city, bigger than the earth, bigger than the sky. God is bigger than everything. Now, if I can tell this to my 2-year-old child, to my 8-year-old daughter, and they have no problem with it, they seem relieved and grow up healthy, how come we can't tell it to grown-ups? I thank Allah, every one of our children, they have no problem. They're not into no crazy, weird spiritual bands. Not a one that has grown up in our house have gone spiritually crazy. And it's because we tell them just plainly. And God is not to be seen with these physical eyes. We have to tell them that. Because in this society, in this Western environment, we think you can see God with a physical eye. That God is the black man, or God is the white man. We have to tell them, you cannot see God with the physical eye. But you can see God. And everyone should want to see God one day. If you haven't seen God, you should want to see God. But you see God with your soul. That's the way you see God, with your soul. And you see God in his effect on his creation. God has created his effect on his creation. His effect explains the beauty and the logic of the whole material scheme. one designer with one purpose, who needed this world for himself? Not. He did not need this world for himself. This is the idea of Christian love, huh? The love that Christians understand, the divine love. He didn't create this world because he needed it. And this is the idea of mercy, divine mercy. In Islam, we don't call it divine love, we call it divine mercy, Allah's mercy. He created this world so that man would come to know himself. See, he created us not knowing our own selves, and come to know his creator, and come to utilize all of the great treasures that God has put into this great scheme we call the universe. He created us to utilize it all for the benefit of mankind. This is the God in Islam. Thank you. Next. Wa alaikum assalam. Yes.
My first question was, you used to say that, well, the white man's practice of white superiority, and then we move from the earth. I don't know how to put it on about the white superiority groups in the city, like the 19, I think, are the certain relations, like the thing happening in Oklahoma City, or in Albany, stuff like that. I was thinking that is involved.
Yes. You know, sometimes the thing dies, especially a thing with a strong lid, a strong will, a creature with a strong will, but it dies. It can't get up on its feet again. It will never stand on its feet again. But it holds on to life, though it's dying. And when anything comes and threatens it, it tempts to try to get itself up on its feet again. That's how these groups are. They're a thing that's been dealt the death blow. And the little movement we see in them is just throes of death. Just expressions of the dead, that's all. They can't get anywhere. I tell my brothers when we meet, my African-American colleagues, the leaders of this community, I tell them when we meet, don't worry about Klan, don't worry about the flinthead, skinhead, and none of these other Nazi groups, don't worry about any of them. The government can't handle them. If I can get me a bullhorn or get on the wire, believe me, we'll take care of them in one day. They're not any great threat anymore. Don't worry about it. But don't ignore them. You got to watch them. And we watch. We're watching. And we got some very good watches too. That's true.
So, what I would love to ask is, how do you go about saying to the people that if you're sitting in a racism and America changed so much of the day, why are you so having so many programs trying to make black people the people or something, black people and the people trying to be white?
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes. The law and the circumstances for centuries favored all white people and did not favor blacks. So you can change the law. The law can change, but still the patterns, so they speak of built-in or institutional racism, you know. So the patterns still stay there. But to me, this is nothing for alarm. That doesn't alarm me at all.
I accept that challenge. So their whites going to benefit from their whites, from whites being established in the position of authority and power. Their whites going to benefit. And we are at a disadvantage, no doubt. But aren't other people who come here too at a disadvantage? And going away from here is not the answer to me, where we will be black all together in one situation and won't have that disadvantage, because they will still have advantage, though a distance away. And an advantage a distance away, as a boxer, I never boxed professionally, but I know the art. I know an advantage of a tall man, with a long reach, distant from me, is more dangerous for me than his advantage of close. The closer I get to him, the less his advantage is over me. I get right in his chest, I might have the advantage. And that's just what I want to do in America. I want to get in the chest of this superior white man and compete with him. I want to get right in his chest and compete vigorously with him.
The last one here, this will be the last question for, like I said, Thomas Sutherland. You can make a question to the about
the UK. Yes, all right, thank you.
Thanks, brother.
Wa alaikum assalam.
One question here. The last one for the media world of Oklahoma City.
What's that?
The last one for the media of Oklahoma City about search and design of the government. About search. Any city, the government or the world trying to take it up. The white people
yes.
What should be our reaction to the people being us Muslims? What kind of steps should we take to combat that situation?
Yes. 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 First of all, I thank Allah that it wasn't people who identify as Muslims. That's the first. Because if it had been, it would just open up so many problems and put so many Muslims' life in danger and jeopardy and danger. So we thank Allah that it wasn't any of our Muslim brothers who did such thing. Now, first thing, if we are really to be counted in those who have that surah that I mentioned, that human picture that Allah created for everybody, if we are really that human being as Muslims, then when we heard of that tragedy and saw the victims of the explosion, of the explosives, dead, maimed, bleeding, it should touch our hearts very deeply. And we are American, we are American citizens. We are not a rich community, but I already pledged $1,000 to the victims there, of our money, as a gesture. We don't have it, but we should. The poor man should do something. Even the poor man should do something. So I'd be doing it as a gesture. And I think if Muslims here in this country, native-born, nationalized citizens, and Muslims abroad, if they would take this tragedy as an opportunity to put Muslims on record for expressing their human excellence, reaching out with the hand of humanity to the victims of those who are brutal and have no humanity, I think it would do a lot to remove from the air a lot of the ugliness that the world, the Western world, associates with us. So I think this is the time for us to act from our heart, to act upon our humanity, or from our humanity, but also to act upon our wisdom. And it would be wise for us to make a gesture to those people, to those victims, and be on record among those who extending to them the hand of sympathy and help.
Yes, sir.
Walaikum As-Salaam. I thought he said that was the last one, but you're talking, so go on. Go on.
Okay, first of all, I'd like to, on behalf of the National Black Youth Corps, I'd like to thank you for taking the time to come here to deliver a little bit of a powerful message to us. I'm constantly asking you two questions to ask me all the time. Who do you know among the Islamic people? And who are you with among the Islamic people? I love the Lord,
let me let you all in on a little secret. I'm running from the old teachings, the old supreme wisdom. I'm running from it. And I'm running from all those who identify with it. But I'm not running so fast that I lose sight of them. I don't want to get so far ahead of them that I can't see them back there. I think you understand what I'm saying. I'm not hearing it very well from there. The question was, what should we do to stabilize our families, our mosques and churches, and our families? Yes. What is needed most? Yes, that's the problem too. We don't have stable homes. We don't have stable families. The picture of the race doesn't say that we have stable homes or stable families. We know some of us do, but that's not the picture for the race. And we don't have stable communities. That's true. And what I think is needed most is what we had before the kind of termination of the freedom movement. What we had from Frederick Douglass and maybe even before him to Dr. Martin Luther King was African American leadership that we respected because of their character, that their better character, and we respected because of their better mind. And that's what we need to do. We need to bring back respect for leadership based upon character and the maturity of the intellect, not just knowledge. A lot of wise people are very criminal, abusive, etc. Educated people can be criminal. Educated people can be abusive. Educated people can be oppressors. And we shouldn't support that kind of leadership. We should support the best human leadership and look for those who have best learned and best experienced and have the best character. And all of us should work to lift up an intelligentsia of African Americans. That's what we should do. And let them detect things, detect problems coming, help us address those problems, and help us work out a better life for ourselves on this earth. Don't let anybody tell you that people don't need leadership. The people as far behind as we are, even today, we need great leadership. But we don't need leaders who will just mash emotional buttons and get responses from us, for us to follow and support them. No, we need people who respect our intelligence and come straight through the door of our intelligence and not be mashing emotional buttons to get us to respond to them so they can empty our pockets or set us up for self-destruction. Thank you.
For more on the ministry of Imam W. Dean Muhammad, Muslim American spokesman for human salvation, call or write WDM Publications. Call 1-708-862-7733 or write Post Office Box 1944, Calumet City, Illinois, 60409. For Muslim Journal, see local distributor. Thanks for listening.